WHD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Stacy Lynn. We begin with the presidential election in Mexico, where millions of voters will head to the polls today.
Presidenta! Presidenta!
It's almost for sure Mexico will have a presidenta, or female president.
Presidenta!
Both top candidates are women, trailblazers, but very different. Frontrunner Claudia Sheinbaum favors the socialist policies of current leader AMLO. Xochitl Galvez is a former senator from Mexico's conservative party who says Mexico's socialized medicine system is failing. Adrian Bard, CBS News, Mexico City.
South Africa's president is under growing pressure after leading the ruling ANC party to its worst election result in 30 years, forcing it to share power. BBC correspondent Barbara Plett-Usher is in Johannesburg.
The results aren't official yet, but they're clear. The ANC has lost the outright majority it held for 30 years. The most dramatic political shift since the end of apartheid. This is uncharted territory.
We ask for all electoral stakeholders to please remain calm, for leaders to lead this nation at this time, and for voices of reason to continue to prevail.
President Biden has endorsed a ceasefire deal to end the war in Gaza. But while many Israelis are pushing Prime Minister Netanyahu to agree to it, he says it won't happen until all the hostages are released and Hamas is out of power. The BBC's Mohammed Taha.
President Biden announced this Israeli for ceasefire, but apparently the first not to accept the proposal is the Israeli government. Hamas also, they are requiring clarifications.
A surprise stop at a defense summit in Singapore for Ukrainian President Zelensky. He met with Secretary Austin and other defense leaders.
Together with partners, we are defending life and rules-based world order. We are working to obtain air defense systems and co-produce weaponry and drones. And we train our soldiers together. And we counter cyber threats together. We restore energy infrastructure damaged by Russian terror together.
And are you ready for some pandemonium? The Smithsonian's National Zoo just announced that a pair of two-year-old giant pandas from China will be moving in by the end of the year. And with these new tenants comes a limited edition line of black and white pandas are coming merch, including hats, t-shirts, baby onesies, tote bags, and water bottles. The panda swag is available at all of the zoo's gift shops, or you can get them online at nationalzoopanda.com. This is CBS News.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
4 Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. The Bay of Green Bay is nominated to join the 31 habitats of the Natural Estuarine Research Reserve System. Mark Richardson explains the significance.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, called NOAA, has designated the bay on Lake Michigan as the 31st site of habitats along the Great Lakes, coastal states, and territories. Brian Glenazinski, with the Great Lakes Initiative of Ducks Unlimited, says it's a huge win for the region's conservationists.
Some of the things that we gain from the other reserves around the country will not only inform what's happening in Green Bay, but also to tell us what's different about Green Bay and what we need to focus on.
If designated, the proposed site would make Wisconsin one of only 3 states with multiple reserves, along with California, Florida, and South Carolina. Financial support from the state, the Oneida Nation, and the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin would fund a position on the reserve staff to ensure that tribal nation perspectives are representative in the site's management and operations.
They continue to provide excellent partnership and the unique perspective that only they can bring to the table.
The proposed reserve is composed of three areas covering almost 38,000 acres of land and water, selected to reflect the unique nature of a large Great Lakes estuary. Lenasinski says the designation is a major accomplishment for the region's conservationists.
That conservation community is pretty special and robust in the area. To have a research reserve like this being placed in an existing conservation community is really just going to take us all to the next level.
For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Mark Richardson. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trusts.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll have a little fog, then we'll see a mix of clouds and sunshine, southeast to southerly winds, and highs warming to the lower 80s. Chances of showers and storms rolling in for Sunday night. Some of the rain could be locally heavy, lows in the low to mid 60s. Right now, it's 51.
Crude and Dom.
Tune in to the next Devil's Advocates radio show. We'll tell you whether or not Trump is fleeing prosecution to a extraditionalist country. Tune in Monday.
The Devil's Advocates, weekdays 4 till 6.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, Eau Claire, the Valley's home of Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's a good day to be indigenous. Get up,
stand up. They are going to become more brutal.
Couldn't cut, hitting cut again.
Because all the hippies were trying to be Indians anyway.
They're going to become more repressive because it's a matter of dollars and their illusionary concepts of power.
Hey, Victor.
We must live in balance with the earth.
And also with recent happenings at Wounded Knee.
I am awake.
Welcome to Native Roots Radio Presents I'm Awake, and I'm your host, Wakunja Hade. Hey, Kadagi, to all my friends and relatives in four directions. You are listening to Native Roots Radio Presents I'm Awake, and I'm your host, Robert Pilot. Hey, we discuss local, national, Native news and events. And as you know, Chujunk, Native issues are human issues, and human issues are Native issues.
Yes, you are right, Dega. And this portion of the show is supported by Little Moments Count, which is a statewide collaborative focused on helping parents and caregivers learn about the importance of brain development in the first 3 years of life. For more information, you can visit littlemomentscount.org.
Hey, you know, Native Roots Radio is excited to be partnering with Little Moments Count to host conversations, you know, focused on early childhood development. We bring guests on once a month to talk about how they view the role of early childhood development in creating bright futures and strong communities. You know, today we have Dr. Debbie Reese, founder of American Indian and Children's Literature, on today. I'm really excited to have Dr. Debbie Reese on. Welcome.
Thanks, Robert, for having me on the show. I'm glad to be here.
Right on. Hey, I was wondering if you could introduce yourself in a good way of like your credentials and your bio a little bit.
All right. I was born at an Indian hospital near our reservation, which is Nambe Owinge, in our language, Nambe Owinge, rather than Nambe Pueblo. And I grew up wanting to be a teacher. Anyway, I do that very much in my work now as an adult, helping people understand who we are as Native people. I have a degree in education and a PhD in early childhood education. And the emphasis of all of my work has been on books, children's books, and storytelling.
Wow.
I have that blog, American Indians and Children's Literature, that I started because the other thing that happens when you become an academic is you're supposed to publish in journals and books that real people that I know that are teachers and librarians can't afford. So I started a blog to give everyone access to the work I was doing.
Wow, that's exciting. Reading is fundamental. And I remember years ago, they had that. I really enjoyed reading, and it's really good. And lately, for me, there's been a lot of really great Native American books coming out. Could you share your journey in studying depictions of Native peoples and children's books, and what inspired you to focus in this area?
Well, I was doing family and math literacy at home on our reservation, and I had already been a school teacher for some years and decided I wanted to go to graduate school, and I chose the University of Illinois. I was warned ahead of time that there was a mascot there, but I thought, nah, that's just not a big deal. And I got to Illinois and found out how big a deal it actually was. People there were incredibly ignorant, and I thought, what did they get? Where are they getting all of this information, they said, about who we are? And because I'm so invested in storytelling and children's books, I shifted my focus away from family literacy to just looking at the content of children's books, those ones that are very popular, that are award-winning books, the kind that you can buy at Kmart or Target. And I saw how many of those very popular books had stereotypical images of Native people. And it sort of fit with what I was seeing in the mascots, that they're stereotypical. And so children across the country have been fed misrepresentations from their early years that help them embrace stereotypical mascots when they become older. So that's kind of in a nutshell how I began this work was just the lived experiences I was having in Illinois.
Wow, that's an amazing thing. And that was 30 years ago when people really, we had Dancing with Kevin Costner coming out with the movies, but we also had our own smoke signals and a lot of books and a lot of things happening then. You know, how did your early experiences like helping at a Head Start program and teaching your siblings shape your understanding in early childhood education and its importance?
Well, I think that part of what I was doing as a child, as a young person, spending time in educational spaces there at the Pueblo, I was just immersed in who we are and why that mattered, community and how that works towards self-esteem and understanding who you are. And then I know that I was seeing stereotypical images as a child, but they seemed to like run off my back. They didn't impact me because I think I was growing up in a community that affirmed who I was and who we are. That didn't even look like anything I understood when I was a kid. So it was just kind of like cartoons of some sort. They didn't matter to me. But moving away from home, I learned just how much those things matter, especially when I went to Illinois. I understood that a lot of what Native kids growing up on reservations immersed in their community and traditions are getting from their community, and what they're not getting from the books that the teachers give to them or that are in the libraries.
Do you think a lot of that has to do with maybe our young ones not interested in school at times because of the false narrative?
Yes, definitely. It's no fun to be a Native kid who knows who you are trying to speak to a teacher who is rejecting your words. That does happen to Native kids who are growing up in areas of the country where there is not a Native population that can counter by your very presence stereotypical imagery. And so I think that we have many places in the country where there are Native people have been completely removed from the area as Illinois. There are were no reservations in Illinois. I think there's something changing there now with Potawatomi maybe. Mm-hmm. We need to have better materials for kids, and they do disengage. And there are studies from various research organizations that document that talk to kids. And it kind of, the study I'm thinking of was one about civil rights, and it includes a component about Native kids and how they disengage every year in school. They just start to disengage more and more. And some of the discussion about that had to do with lack of solid, accurate content that represented who they are. If you're asked to regurgitate nonsense, you know, you just step back. And mm-hmm. our kids step back year after year after year.
Yeah, well, that's really important, your work, because I know, being an educator myself, I taught for 30 years in the high school, that, you know, the librarians and people that want to have accurate representation really need to be educated a lot of times too. And with your blog and things like that, what specific criteria or resources should we use to have this accurate representation in all schools?
Well, I certainly invite people to come to my blog. I have been doing that blog for, 18 years now, I think. And so it consists of critical analysis of popular books that have stereotypical content in them, but it also includes books that I think should be in every classroom because they function as mirrors for kids, Native kids in particular, who are looking for stories that in some way reflect who they are. My site is one. Also, the American Indian Library Association has an annual book award, a biannual book award, and that's also another good place for information.
Wow. I just want to say we are here with Dr. Debbie Reese, founder of American Indians and Children Literature, and we'll be right back after a short break. You're listening to Native Roots Radio.
We are Alusa Nation.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap Eau Claire, the Chippewa Valley's home for the Devil's Advocates radio show.
Hey there, it's Carrie Joy with your Work Money Minute. Today, let's tackle a big question in a short amount of time. How much money do you need to save for retirement? It's not the same for everybody. If you think 10 times your annual pre-retirement income, that's in the right ballpark. But what is pre-retirement income? And how do I save that much money? Okay, don't stress about the big number. The simplest and most effective way I know is to save about 15% of your income each year. If you're starting later in life, like in your 40s, you probably have to save more than that 15%. But the bottom line is, start saving now, as much as you can, and put it in retirement accounts where it can grow. Some savings is always better than none. Now, there's an awful lot more to say about this topic, which I did over on my YouTube channel. You can check it out if you want to dive in deeper. Search for Work Money Media on YouTube. Till then, this is Carrie Joy saying, take good care.
93.5 The Tap.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Leonard Peltier. I am in Coleman 1, U.S. Penitentiary, and I'm listening to Native Roots Radio.
And we're back to Native Roots Radio Presents I'm Awake, and this is Robert Pilot.
This portion of the show is supported by Little Moments Count. Nearly 80% of brain growth happens in the first 1,000 days, and small moments of interaction like talking, playing, reading, and singing help create the pathways that build a child's brain during this early stage of life. For more information, you can visit littlemomentscount.org.
Wow. Yeah, that's a good point, too. Singing. I love that. We're here with Dr. Debbie Reese, founder of American Indians and Children's Literature, and we're talking a little bit about educating our libraries and our librarians and people that send out kind of those kind of messages and via books and things like that. And I know Dr. Debbie Reese, we over the years we've had literature come out from people that claim that they're Native and aren't even Native.
Yes, that's a real problem. And we are addressing that. I have addressed that several times in the last year, especially on my blog, where we have people who find each other and form a tribe, and then they write books as though they are actually Native people. And it's a very contentious but important topic to take up.
Yeah, really. It really is, because, you know, it's very confusing, too, at times. As a former educator, what advice do you have for educators who encounter resistance when they try to introduce culturally accurate Native literature into their curriculum?
Well, as when I'm doing professional development with teachers and librarians, I can tell when they sign up for these sessions that I do, they care, but they're also afraid because they are the only person that's doing that. And so my recommendation is that you find somebody to form a cohort, that a team orientation, a community orientation, which is a lot like what we do in our native communities. We form teams that can work on a problem of one kind or another. And I think that's what educators need to do, is find like-minded teachers and librarians and parents, people in the community who you can talk with and talk through these things, because you have to read a book and understand what's in there and why it's a problem. And saying those words with another person helps you to defend what you're doing as an educator when you're using a book or choosing not to use a book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know also, too, there's that fine line for our white allies to join us and not speak for us, too. So there's a balancing act in education all the time, especially with our allies that really want to do well for our kids.
There is. And it's really important that when they are doing that work, that they be aware of the native voices that they may inadvertently silence by speaking up when they should be listening.
Yeah. Wow. Really good point. Why do you believe it's essential for native voices to lead the creation of literature about native cultures rather than non-native writers? We see a lot of that.
We do. And I grew up at home being taught by the elders, there are things that we keep private, things we don't talk about. I remember very clearly elders saying, don't go tell your teachers what we do here. Mm-hmm. Because of a history of exploitation and a history of harmful legislation and policies that essentially drove a lot of our religious ways underground. They became mm-hmm. secret. So we do keep things private, and Native writers who grew up with their communities know that. They don't spill their guts in the way someone who did not grow up with that teaching can do. In a certain sense, we can think about something like a naming ceremony. We don't give all those details. Native people who are writing books don't give all those details, because too many non-Native people want to come up with an Indian name. So they'll create a ceremony based on what they find in something written by a Native person.
Yeah, definitely.
In a nutshell, we know what to hold back. We know what to keep private.
I know, and I don't know if you remember, this is kind of off topic, but it was like 20 years ago, somebody was doing sweats and killing people, and it was unbelievable that this shaman there was speaking and doing these things that were closely that we do in our culture. So you're absolutely right about that, and especially with literature. Yeah, I can't wait. I'm going to go definitely check on your blog. That's really some really good information that we need to talk about and spread here on Native Roots Radio. How do your professional development sessions address the deep-seated stereotypes? And I think you talked a little bit about that, but the misinformation that's perpetrated in certain children's books that are out there and been out there for years.
Well, part of what I'm trying to do in my professional development is based on what I hear from teachers and writers. Teachers will say things like, oh, I brought Charisse's Big Voice, you know, that's the by Ho-Chunk congressperson Charisse Davids, mm-hmm. and she has a picture book. But so we have books by Native people being written, and when teachers try to bring them into the classroom, the kids are like, is that really an Indian book? They don't believe it is a story about Native people because it doesn't have feathers and ceremony in it. And so when I think about that, I think, okay, so what do we have to get rid of? What do we have to see pushed aside so that children know better when they are picking up books by Native writers? So we need to look carefully at Little House on the Prairie. Mm. And in my professional development workshops, I look very carefully at these classic and award-winning books. I bring sets of them and I hand them out and I say, okay, I want you to read the second paragraph on page 9. Mm-hmm. And teachers and librarians then go through an oral study with me in the session. And they are usually quite stunned and shaken by the things that are in books like Little House on the Prairie, because that one has the only good Indian is a dead Indian at three different times, right? So there's, so we have to come to a space of knowing that those classics are deeply biased and deeply hurtful and inaccurate. They just have mistakes in them.
Mm-hmm.
And so being able to see that we are teachers, we are educators, and when we use a book that has stereotypes and bad history, we are miseducating the children in our classrooms. And that's not why we chose to become educators. So helping them see that is really important.
Well, that's amazing too. And sometimes because of the TV series was so popular, I forget that was a Laura Ingalls book series many years ago that was really revered by a lot of schools and teachers over the years.
It still is. It is still used in schools across the country.
Wow. Okay. Wow. Wow, you have your hands full with just that book here. You know, that's again the inaccuracy of our people, and it, you know, when you hear terms like that, you think of the president that really disliked us too when he was moving westward, and what are some of the key takeaways for educators and librarians? And I know. Like we have State Senator Mary Kunish, who is a former librarian in schools, and there was a book recently written about the Ho-Chunk's removal in Minnesota that was written by an author from the University of Minnesota library part and did a lot of research on that. It's so important to have librarians on the same page.
It is crucial that librarians who are information providers, that's what they do, be able to read books that help them come to a better place of knowing regarding who we are. Being able to say, yeah, I thought that was a good book, and man, it is not a good book. And being able to set it aside and remove it from their collection, from their library collections. We're in a very dicey time because people say, censorship.
Right.
They default to that. And it's really not a question of censorship. It's a question of accuracy of materials that we're putting on the shelves for children. We as a society have changed in many, many ways over time. Like there was a time when we had Little Black Sambo in libraries everywhere. That's not the case anymore. We understand that's stereotypical. The Richard Scarry books were full of stereotypes of Native people, and those have been changed, and librarians are taking the old ones out and putting the new ones in. We can grow in those ways if we know what's out there.
Well, I would really like you to bring up your blog and how people can read that again. We are here with Dr. Debbie Reese, founder of American Indians in Children's Literature. Haley, I would love to have the doctor on again, and once I go over her blog again, because this is very interesting information that everybody needs to know.
Yeah, definitely give out your blog information. I was looking at it before the show, and there's just full of really great information and different pieces of literature, and I think it's so important. I know we have a minute left here. Why don't we give out that information quickly?
Okay, it's called American Indians in Children's Literature. That's the name of the blog. And if you put that in your search engine, whichever search program you use, you'll find it. And come over there and read what I've written over the last 15 years and submit comments, because I do respond, especially to teachers and librarians who are looking for help.
Wow. Dr. Debbie Reese, I wanted to say a big thank you, a big pina gigi, and again, we'd love to have you on the show again. And this is a deep dive for us here, and our allies are really interested, along with our Native listeners, on this, especially with the history.
Thank you. I'd be glad to come back.
Excellent. Thank you. Hey, this is Native Roots Radio presents I'm Awake, and we'll be back after this short break.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, Eau Claire, Chippewa Valley's home for the Todd Allball Show. CBS News Brief. Millions in Mexico are hitting the polls today to elect a new president. CBS's Adrian Bard is in Mexico City.
Presidenta! Presidenta!
It's almost for sure Mexico will have a presidenta, or female president. Both top candidates are women.
In South Africa's elections, the ANC has lost its majority for the first time since 1994. This means the formation of the nation's first coalition government is likely.
We ask for all electoral stakeholders to please remain calm and for voices of reason to continue to prevail.
A ceasefire deal is on the table to end the war in Gaza, but there are questions from both sides. The BBC's Mohammed Taha.
Apparently, the first not to accept the proposal is the Israeli government.
Prime Minister Netanyahu says it won't happen until all the hostages are released and Hamas is out of power. CBS News Brief. I'm Stacey Lynn.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
The Brewers bank another win. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. It took 10 innings, but the Brewers able to pull off a 4-3 win over the Chicago White Sox. The Sox led 3-1 before Willie Adames came up with this clutch hit in the bottom of the seventh with two outs driving in two runs. Coverage Bally Sports Wisconsin.
They're loaded up for 1-1. Adames up the middle. It's through a base hit in the score terrain. Contreras to the plate, and he is in there. A close play at second. Yelich just got back.
Adames would later drive in the winning run in the bottom of the 10th. Pat Murphy said a lot of players contributed.
They kept themselves in the game. They played defense. Chirios catch, a couple Perkins' catches. Chirios catch in right field. You know, double play we turned with Ortiz. His footwork was great. Turn by Terang was great. It's a good win. It's a good win because it can go the other way real quick.
That's Brewers manager Pat Murphy. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. We'll have a little fog, then we'll see a mix of clouds and sunshine, southeast to southerly winds, and highs warming to the lower 80s. Chances of showers and storms rolling in for Sunday night. Some of the rain could be locally heavy. Lows in the low to mid 60s. It's 53 at our studios.
It's fair time across Wisconsin, and with more than 70 county fairs, three district fairs, and the state fair, there's something for everyone to enjoy, including classic carnival games like Skee Ball, made in Wisconsin. You just roll that ball up a ramp and use enough strength to hop the ball into one of the bullseye rings, then add up your points. So what is the actual object of Skee Ball? To show off your bowling-like skills to your friends, to work on your attention span, or to win a prize like a stuffed animal? The answer coming up. Skee Ball is close to 110 years old. It's made in Pulaski, Wisconsin by Baytech Games. The company itself originally started in a basement. Now, do you know the object of the Skee Ball game? It really is to add up your points and win a prize like a stuffed animal. One fun slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
One of the most prolific columnists in the Midwest. Mr. James Causey, one of your columns, you mentioned that you got into the news because of the news quiz.
Yes. I would like to be the first person picked. And so.
Yes. Getting picked first for the news quiz teams.
We need to bring that back, actually. I need to talk to my paper about bringing that back.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Melissa was my neighbor in L.A. Her husband, Jim, would break open these $100 bottles of wine they just have sitting around.
A friend of mine and I went to his friend's house. Her dad put like a $500 bottle of scotch down on the table and was like, hey, I got this for you guys. Like, go ahead. We're 18. We can't appreciate this. I've never had an alcoholic beverage in my life until my 21st birthday.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba. Weeknights 7 till 9 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Maggie Dawn.
Next up, we kick off Biden's top 100. The week's theme is the economy, and we'll be specifically talking about the billionaires tax. Why don't we tax billionaires more?
The Maggie Dawn Show, weekday afternoons from 2 till 4.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Anin, I'm Lieutenant Governor Peggy Flanagan, and you are listening to Native Roots Radio.
Welcome back to Native Roots Radio Presents I'm Awake, and this is Robert Pilot.
This portion of Native Roots Radio is presented in partnership with Little Moments Count. For more information, you can visit littlemomentscount.org.
Hey, we are here with Debbie Reese, founder of American Indians and Child Literature, and we're really excited to talk about a lot of things here about older literature, getting correct information out there. Haley, this has been a really interesting show for me. I love to read books, and I can't wait to jump on Dr. Debbie Reese's blog. Thank you.
Yeah. Of course. Well, you know, I think when I saw that Debbie was coming on today and she was our guest with Little Moments Count, I was so excited because, you know, we've had Mary Kunish on the show who's talked about getting, we just passed that law in Minnesota. I don't know if you know Dr. Reese, but Native American or American Indian education is now required in all K-12 schools, I believe, in the state. And this went into effect this previous school year. And I know that during Indigenous Peoples Month, or I think maybe it was Indigenous Peoples Day, a lot of teachers were not able to, and in fact, did not, you know, carry out any education in the classroom. And because of that, they said they couldn't find the right information or enough literature or correct, you know, information on what to educate their students. So I think your blog post is a really great resource for a lot of our teachers out there.
Thank you. Yeah, there's, you know, when I think about teachers who can't find materials, I wonder, where are they looking? Where are they not looking? What is their criteria? I wonder too if they think that what they need to give to kids on that day are what is widely marketed as folk tales and myths and legends. And the realities are that most of those books out there were not written by Native people, and they were misrepresentations of the teachings of those stories. But they are popular. That's what people want. You know, that's what the consumer wants, is myths and legends and folk tales. What Native writers want are books that look like them as they are growing up in the United States. So they're looking for books for their kids that look like they are today. So we are seeing a huge growth in picture books about Native people set in the present day. And I'd really like to see those being used in classrooms. A lot of those traditional things that get called folk tales, that's sacrilegious. A lot of those stories are actually sacred stories that white writers don't know are sacred stories, because we have such a history of miseducating people about who we are. So there's so many good choices. I get very fired up about some writers and what they're doing.
Well, we were talking about state or representative Sharice David's picture book, but I know there was also a Ho-Chunk young lady who is also a ballerina dancer who did a book, and also thank you, Haley.
Rhea Thundercloud.
Thank you, Haley. And she
she's also Pueblo.
Well, she doesn't have to claim that though. No, but I mean, that's what you're saying, is that she's dancing, but also how she can put it to combine both traditional and ballet as a 21st century person.
Right. Right. We see many of those kinds of books, like hers is very good. I was listening to the announcements before we came back on, and I heard Penny Flanagan's voice. There is a book about Peggy Flanagan.
Yeah.
I'm really excited about that. And the truths that are in there are so good. Like, there's a page where she's talking about where the biographer has written about Peggy in school and being taught about Christopher Columbus. And Peggy knows, you know, he didn't discover America. And so her as a child is thinking, but wait, that's not true. And I think that's a huge issue for so many of our kids, that disengagement that we go through when they come to a book that has wrong information and they know it's wrong, then what do? Most kids just sail right past that. And our Native kids are like stuck in that moment. And then they have to do something like take a spelling test. How are they going to fare on that spelling test when they're stuck on that moment, when their teacher has told them something that's not true? So I thought of that page in that book about Peggy Flanagan when you were when the announcer was talking. Well, it was her.
Yeah.
It was her voice there. And right. and some other, if I could, and I don't know how much time we have, but a couple writers who I would really like people to know about are Kim Rogers. Kim Rogers has a few picture books out. She's a new writer in the last 5 years. One of my favorite books that she did is called A Letter for Bob. It's a picture book about a car that a Native family has, and they've named it Bob. And but it's time to get a new car. And so they're reminiscing about all the things and places they went to with Bob. Great, great book. And another one is Lori Goodluck. She's also a Native writer, and she has several books coming out. She did one called Forever Cousins. And in that book, you learn about a little, two little girls are cousins. They're friends. They hang out in the San Francisco Bay Area. But then one of them is moving back to the reservation. And the questions about, well, wait a minute, why are there Native people in the San Francisco Bay Area in the first place? And so she's got an author's note in her book where she says, Native people were moved to these urban areas by a federal government act that enticed people to leave their homes so their land could become available.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the information you get from Native writers, they are writing author's notes that tell teachers, here's the information you need to best use this book in your classroom. So I really am very keen on Kim Rogers and Lori Goodluck, two of many.
Over the years, we've had Tommy Orange on, and also, who's our mystery writer here in Minnesota, Haley?
Oh, Marcy. Are you talking Marcy Rendon?
Yes.
Yes.
We've had her on, and I mean, there's a great writer right there that has a twist of maybe back on the res and things that are happening there and put it into a murder mystery.
Her books are excellent. I do know I have many of her books, and she has picture books too. She has a picture book coming out. When that book comes out, you should have her on the show so that your readers can become familiar with her picture books. I knew her first as a writer of children's books and then later as these mysteries that she's writing. And I'll tell you, every workshop that I do, I say, instead of Tony Hillerman, reach for Marcy Rendon.
Yes. Right.
Nice. Hillerman was an outsider who does not know what to share, what not to share. We don't know what he's making up in his books, but we can reach for Native writers who do better for us all.
Wow. 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 The really interesting, Haley and Dr. Reese, really interesting. We've really, you know, and Tommy Orange, I don't know if you, he had a new book just come out recently, but I know it was funny. The first book he said that took him 10 years to write because he was working full time, you know, and now he's able to be a writer. And the second book took a couple years, but still it's exciting to have these young writers and writers writing Native things that are real and realistic, like you said, Dr. Reese.
It is. These are hopeful moments when we're seeing more Native writers who are writing for adults and Native writers who are writing for children getting published by the mainstream big publishers. Those big publishers have funds, they have money that can help them market the books that so that when you go into a Barnes and Noble and you see all that swag, you know, all those cool things, mm-hmm. that's what you get when you get published by a major publisher. So we're seeing an uptick in that in the field. What's really necessary though is that people buy those books. They can't just like be glad that they exist. They have to buy them, because publishers are not publishing books because they like us Native people. They're publishing because they want to make some money. Mm-hmm. Making money means we as Native people have to buy those books and talk about those books and tell others about those books. We have to go to the library and ask for that book, because then the library will buy it. We have to go to the bookstores and ask for it there, because then they will put it on the shelf. We can be activists in ways I think that we're not aware of if we just be more vocal about the books that are written by our Native writers.
Well, we have like Moon Palace Bookstore, who's privately run, and then also we have the big bookstore we were going to talk about, Haley.
Birch Bark Bookstore in Minneapolis.
Yeah, so you know, we try to make sure that people you know, you have to get things at Barnes and Nobles for sure, but you really support our local book dealers too.
Yeah, and I've been to Birchbark books many times, and gosh, Louise Erdrich's books are amazing, and people should be reading those too. She's got some for children. She wrote a series called Birchbark House that is set in the same time period of Little House on the Prairie. Hmm. And it is definitely something that people should reach for instead of Little House on the Prairie, because it is about those early contact periods and the ways that Native and non-Native people were encountering each other and coming to know each other and figuring out how they're going to go forward together. So definitely think that people should be more aware of her historical fiction for children.
Yeah, and she's prolific. She is writing, and it's great to have her in the community here in the Twin Cities, but all nationally too. She's renowned.
Yes, she is. And I do recommend her adult books, some of them in particular, like The Roundhouse and The Sentence, because I think that in order for teachers and librarians to better select and deselect, which means removing books, from your library, you have to know what that voice is like. And so reading her books, the ones that I think will work better for teachers and librarians, I recommend those because that helps them embrace and just become more knowledgeable of Native voice and what Native writers are writing.
Wow, this has been a really good show. Let's talk about your blog one more time, and anything else that you'd like to finish with. Really appreciate you doing overtime with us on three segments.
Okay, my blog is American Indians and Children's Literature, and I think my next post on there is going to be about Super Indian. If you and your readers don't know about Aragon Starr and her series of books called Super Indian, it is a graphic novel, and it's about a person who has commodity cheese and people who are Native who have powers because of some of this. I don't want to say a whole lot, but I love it. And what she's doing with her graphic novels, the volume 3 just came out. So there's volume 1, volume 2, Super Indian. Can't say enough about it.
Wow. Big Pina Gigi, thank you so much for coming on. And we want to reach out again. This has been really fascinating and really educational for me and our listeners.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be back another day. Thank you.
Right on. Hey, this is Native Roots Radio Awake. And up next, we got Wendy Pilot with our sacred animal section. We'll be right back after this short break.
Alusa Nation.
This is 93.5 The Tap.
Do you have a loved one in a nursing home? California mega millionaire Eric Hovde has some bad news for you. He doesn't think they have long to live. It's true. In a recent interview, Hovde said, if you're in a nursing home, you only have a 5-6 month life expectancy. Almost nobody in a nursing home is at a point to vote. That's shocking. But it gets worse. One of Hovde's companies is named a co-defendant in a wrongful death suit from an incident at a California senior living facility. He even referred to himself as an expert in the nursing home business. Yikes, that doesn't sound like the kind of expert we need. Call Eric Hovde at his California office, 714-730-4444. Tell him that Wisconsin seniors deserve to vote and get the care they deserve. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together Incorporated.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, the Chippewa Valley's home for Up North News Radio.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Hi, I'm Jane Fonda, and you're listening to Native Roots Radio.
And we're back to Native Roots Radio Presents. I'm Awake, and this is Robert Pilot.
This portion of the show is supported by Howling for Wolves, protecting wolves for future generations.
Howl! Hey, I want to introduce my awesome and beautiful wife, and she's been overworked here on Native Roots Radio on our little travel here in New York, but we really appreciate Wendy. Wendy, come on and introduce yourself.
Yes. Hi, everybody. Hi, my name is Hannah Jihihani, and that means cares for them. I was given that name by my Dega Curtis. Curtis goes by Mashke Hannah Jingo, which means walks on white clouds. I'm a humane policy volunteer leader for the Humane Society of the United States, and I work on animal issues at the local and state level. I want to give a shout out to Curtis, my Dega Curtis. He's not feeling well, so warrior prayers out for Curtis. He was in bed all day today. Yeah, I saw that as a post today. So hopefully he's feeling better. You know, I've been feeling a little bit under the weather too. I don't know whether it's allergies or cold or whatever. Maybe it's just from traveling. I don't know. But today, Howling for Wolves post an information, yes, on social media saying that hunters pushing misinformation continue to cause unnecessary wolf deaths. Even without a wolf hunt, wolf mortality rates are alarmingly high. A 16-year study by the state's DNR shows an annual mortality rate of 43%, with a significant increase in illegal killings after the last legal hunts in 2012. This is far above the sustainable 29% mortality rate proposed by experts. Minnesota wolves are struggling due to poaching, vehicle collisions, and conflict. Further population reductions through public hunts are not only unnecessary, but also harmful, increasing illegal killings, and threatening long-term viability through inbreeding and unstable packs. It's time to focus on science and non-lethal methods to ensure the survival and recovery of our wolf population. So let's work towards a future where wolves thrive in Minnesota. Now, we've been talking about this for as long as we've been on the air, for 7 years. We've been talking about our Minnesota wolves and how important they are to keep around, right, for future generations. That's exactly what our commercial says from Howling for Wolves. So we know we always love the wolf. And I want to thank my husband, Robert, again. Last year, Robert did an awesome job at our state Senate. And he spoke on behalf of Minnesota Wolves. And he gave the Native American perspective about why it's so important to keep our wolves. And I just want to say thanks again, Robert, for doing that. It is on public domain. You could go online and watch his speech or his commentary about the wolf. And I think he really did a great job. But I have, of course, I have a list here of a few fun facts about our gray wolves. And those are the kind of wolves that we have here. Their scientific name for the gray wolf is Canis lupus. Yeah, so we do that. And wolves are the largest members of the Canidae family. That's what they're called. Males average 5 to 6.5 feet in length from nose to the tip of tail. So that's 5 to 6.5 feet. While the females average 4.5 to 6 feet. So they are a lot smaller.
Sure.
Yeah. Most wolves stand at 26 to 32 inches at the shoulder. So I guess, yeah, their head would be a lot higher. But yeah, the shoulder, they're 26 to 32 inches. Females weigh approximately 60 to 80 pounds, where males larger will weigh 70 to 110 pounds. A wolf footprint will measure 4 inches wide by 5 inches long.
Wow.
That's amazing how big their paws are.
Yeah.
Paws are. That's really incredible. And unfortunately, the only time I ever got to see a wolf wasn't even in the wild. It was a captured wolf. Do you remember that place we went to, Robert? I think we took a drive up north one day just to take like a little road trip. And we came upon this place. I wish I could remember the name of it, but you could go and take pictures with wild animals.
Yeah.
So I was like, let's go in there and check this place out. And we went down this long dirt road, really far into the deep woods. And what we found were wild animals in cages. And they let the animal out like for a minute so that you could just like snap a picture with it. So there were bears, there were baby bears, there were wolves, all enclosed in these small structures. And I just couldn't believe it. I was just so upset about it. I started taking pictures, and this guy, the security guy, came out and started yelling at us. I think he had a gun. I can't remember.
Oh, goodness.
But we got in the car fast and went down the road like so fast. He came at us behind us on one of those four wheelers. And yeah, it was like terrible. So I would just encourage people.
Almost got me killed, Haley.
Oh, gosh.
don't take pictures where places say, yeah, you could take a picture with a wild, a coyote or a wolf or a bear, because the animals stay in cages the whole entire time until you are ready to take that picture. Most of the time, the animals, yeah, it's terrible. Mostly all the animals are drugged, or they're, beaten or shown a stick or some type of weapon, that makes them behave out of intimidation. That's what happens. So it's just don't do it. Don't swim with dolphins in the pool at the aquarium. Don't go see dolphin shows. Don't take pictures with wild animals. I could go on and on and on.
Terrible, Wendy, thinking back to that.
As I was talking about this.
It was in the middle of nowhere, too. So how many of these places are scattered around, along with puppy mills, all these things that are so detrimental to our relatives with the hooves, tails, big noses, and...
Right. Well, they have roadside zoos. They have roadside animal, like if you're driving cross country and you're, driving down a, not on the regular highway, but down through the town or through a road, they have these places, and a lot of people just stop, like for $25, take your picture with, this wild animal that we have chained up in the back of the pickup all day.
And they all got and the people running that got like big scars down their face. And...
Oh my goodness.
Well, yeah, there was a story about one, I can't remember where it was, but it was a cougar, and the cougar was just chained up in the back of this pickup, and people would stand in the back of near the pickup where the wildcat was chained up, and you could take a picture with that wildcat. The wildcat was eventually rescued, and there's a video online of it where they they cut the leather leash that was around its neck and then let it free. And that, it was like the first time that this wild cat was, walking around on grass for the first time. How your regular cat at home will make those like kneading, their paws will knead. And this big lion was doing that in the grass. It was probably the first time that he felt the grass, but he spent his whole life in the back of the pickup truck chained up, and people would just take pictures of him there.
Well, Peeny Gee, thank you, Wendy. We're still here. We are the seventh generation. This has been Native Roots Radio.
Free Leonard Peltier.
Now.
Now.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap. John Mino and Jim Schmidt.
On the next show, Brittany Merlot joins us to give us a look at the weather for the week ahead.
And John Plegman from ARDC of Brown County stops by to talk about sobriety night. Join us.
Mino and the Mayor, weekday mornings 6 till 9. Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinaire on Air with Jane Matinaire. Weekdays 10 till noon on the Talk of Eau Claire, 93.5 The Tap, and on the Civic Media app. Max Inc. Radio.
His voice is a dream. Coming up, Eau Claire musician Brian Bethke joins us live for an in-studio concert. I'm Terry Barr. Join me, Rucker, and Jimmy Kay.
Weekend evenings, 6 until midnight, on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us. You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
CBS News Brief. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu is facing growing pressure at home to agree to a ceasefire in Gaza. Lieutenant General Mark Schwartz says he understands why some of his cabinet members don't like the plan.
Israel still has the right to pursue those and bring them to justice, but there's